Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Barry Gordon Lovegrove. He's Professor Emeritus in the School of Life Sciences, University of KwaZulu-Natal. And we're talking about his book, Fires of Life, Endothermy in Birds and Mammals. Barry, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about Fires of Life.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Mark.
I'm going to admit this to the audience. I read a lot of science texts and science books. Very few change the way I think about things radically. Your book did that. Your book changed the way I thought about things. And I want to congratulate you for that.
Oh, thanks very much.
Now, before we get out of the way, let's define endothermy and ectothermy for the audience. What's endothermy?
Endothermy simply means the capacity of... Hello?
Yep, I'm here. Yep.
Hello? We lost you for a while.
Don't worry about it.
Endothermy simply means the capacity of an animal to produce its own heat from within. So this is a metabolic process of heat production, whereas an ectotherm relies almost exclusively on an external heat source, such as that from the sun.
Now, mammals and birds are endothermic. Are any other, any reptiles, amphibians, or fish endothermic?
Well, yes. There's increasing evidence that some of these non-avian and non-avian groups can produce heat in certain parts of the body. For example, swordfish can produce heat in muscles in the eye. And pythons can shiver to produce heat when inflating their eggs. And there's even evidence that insects might use a certain amount of heat production in the muscle work before they fly, for example, in moths. And some evidence in sharks and certain other fish as well. It's growing evidence, but they certainly are not endothermic throughout the body.
Now, before we're going to only be able to talk about some of the research that goes into this book, because this is a very detailed book. But I want to mention there's an interesting secondary theme in this book, and I want you to talk about this. And that's that researchers and scientists in the Southern Hemisphere don't get any respect, or at least they don't get as much attention as scientists in the Northern Hemisphere. Can you talk about that?
It's just a question of sheer numbers. If you look at biologists, for example, or thermobiologists, 90% of thermal biologists live in the Northern Hemisphere. And that tiny percentage, which you literally count on your left hand, occur in the Southern Hemisphere. So, obviously their opinions and their attempts to drive science and be at the cutting edge are just smothered by the sheer volume of science output from the Northern Hemisphere, particularly from North America, of course, and Europe. And sometimes these certain paradigms that are created by the Northern Hemisphere can persist for long periods of time without being challenged adequately. And in this book, what I do challenge the idea that hibernation is this adaptation to these really cold environments, such as you see in Arctic ground squirrels and bears and so on. And I'm arguing that it's not at all. It's something that evolved in the tropics and a long time ago. I think hibernation might be as old as 250 million years old.
Jeez.
It's not a recent evolutionary process that happened at the end of the Cenozoic with the onset of the coolest period of the last 300 million years.
Well, let's start talking about one event and talk about your research based on that. There was a meteoritic impact 66 million years ago. That was disastrous for life on Earth. Can you just talk about that? That was the one that came down in what's the Yucatan now. And almost all the life on the planet was wiped out. What happened?
Well, there were two phases to what happened from what I understand. The first phase was a thermal phase in which the surface of the Earth was exposed to temperatures approaching 1,000 degrees Celsius. I'm not sure what that is in Fahrenheit, but and of course, you would have had spontaneous combustion of anything that was exposed to that heat, that thermal infrared radiation, except perhaps for forests that were covered in clouds, heavily clouded areas. And really, the only animals that escaped that were those that could hide underground or in tree holes, but mostly those that could be underground or underwater. And the rest, they were barbecued.
Wow. So how did mammals survive?
Well, that's one of the points I raise in the book. I personally believe, and that's what I write about, is that they survived because that those early mammals, which are the marsupials and the early placental mammals, could hibernate. And they could hibernate for long periods of time. Our work in Madagascar has shown that the common tenrec, for example, can hibernate for 9 months, and it might even be longer. We had to disturb the hibernation events because the batteries in our telemeters were running out. But that's 9 months without ever arousing. It's just truly remarkable. So if that's any indication of what our early ancestors were like 66 million years ago, and this would have been a small sort of rat-sized insectivore, then it gave them the capacity to survive that first, at least the first year of that ecological disaster.
Barry, I've got to ask you this, because this is the first time I came across this creature. Who or what is Schrödinger?
Well, Schrödinger is a very interesting name. It came about after a very large study which tried to recreate what the ancestral placental mammal might have looked like. And that came from a study of the genes of modern mammals and together with a study of the cladistic analysis of the bones of fossil animals. And they came up with this animal that looked a little bit like the possum, but it's not a possum. And it was an insectivore, but what they created was a theoretical animal. And it's not a real animal because there's no type specimen, there's no real fossil for it. It is a reconstruction using our modern tools of phylogenetic reconstruction. So we faced the problem of what do you call it? And it started out as an internet competition to come up with a name, and Ralph was a leading contender for a while. And then someone came up with this brilliant idea of Schrödinger, and it was a play on the name of Schrödinger, which, of course, Schrödinger's cat is that idea that you have a cat which is both dead and alive at the same time, and it is a concept from nuclear physics. So I thought that was quite clever, and he is still known as Schrödinger today. That's the only name we can assign to it.
Now, before we continue on in your research in hibernation, I want to go back before the Cretaceous-Cenozoic event. Were dinosaurs endothermic?
Oh, absolutely. This is one of the hugest, biggest debates. There's absolutely no doubt they were endothermic. And, well, not all of them, but most certainly a large number of those that were in the pteropod lineage. So they would have started around 300 million years ago at the onset of the Jurassic. There's absolutely no doubt that the pteropods, certainly the more derived ones, were highly endothermic, and probably had even attained a body temperature which was higher than modern mammals today.
Wow.
The feathered dinosaurs, they weren't flying yet, but there's certainly a lot of evidence to suggest that they were endothermic. I mean, why else would they have feathers for at least 60 million years before they flew?
Well, this brings up an interesting point about the Cretaceous-Cenozoic event. I mean, we know that birds are a form of dinosaurs. Somehow birds survived the Cretaceous-Cenozoic event. I can see Schrödinger, some ancient mammal, staying burrowed for months or years. But what about the birds? How did the birds So do we know anything about how birds survive and what species of birds survived the Cenozoic Cretaceous event?
Well, you know, of course, to get down to the species level is impossible at that time. But I think that you must remember there was another group of birds which were called the Enanthothornies, which did not survive. They were also small flighted birds, and they were most forest birds. And it's highly lucky that, of course, the forest ended up in bands, which is why none of them survived. They were more diverse than the modern birds. And but it is the modern birds that survive, and all I can really think of is that if you look at the ancestral groups that got through, they were mostly aquatic.
That's right. That's right.
There are some that we don't understand how they got through. It's, for example, the ratites. But they were small. You know, a ratite is part of the ostrich group and the emus and so on. But the ancestral ratite was a small bird, a flighted bird. And they either got through because they were aquatic. And remember, you only need about 1 millimeter of water on your body surface to avoid being cooked in that first 3 hours because of the heat of vaporization will cool you down. So they were either aquatic or they must have taken refuge in burrows underground or holes in trees.
There is one group of birds, and maybe people have never heard of this, and I've actually seen these. There's a species of Caprimulgiformes that actually hibernate.
Yeah, you see, that's the other thing. They could have got through by hibernating, and so I was really delighted when one of the most recent studies on the family tree of birds, to put it that way, one of the earliest groups, the Caprimulgiformes. So what it says to me is that, hey, the earliest group of birds were hibernators, because the poor world in America is the only bird so far that we know that can hibernate. And it was part of that group. But hibernation has certainly been lost in modern birds, although there are many modern birds that still use daily water, which is a form of hibernation.
And examples are like chickadees in the high north, when they go to sleep at night, will actually cease shivering and lower their body temperature and actually go into this bizarre torpor for the night where their body temperature has been lowered and only start shivering again to revive themselves as daylight comes on.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, hummingbirds of the Americas are the best example of a small bird that has a very high energetic cost of flight and existence. They go into torpor in both summer and winter almost routinely if they're not breeding.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Barry Gordon Lovegrove. He's a professor emeritus in the School of Life Sciences at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. And we're talking about his book. This is one of the best science books I have read this year. Fires of Life, Endothermy in Birds and Mammals. Now, a lot of your research or your field work has been done on hibernation. But before we talk about that, is there a difference between hibernation and torpor?
Well, in both cases, you have a situation in which you have metabolic reduction. And that involves an enormously complex suite of genes which are switched on and off, which basically turn the metabolic rate off for a while. The body temperature cools down, and then it is arrested again at whatever the torpor or hibernation temperature is. And then it's controlled again at that temperature until we are then. But the difference really between hibernation and torpor is that hibernation carries on for longer than 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
It can go on for a month, and then the animal will arouse for 24 hours and go back down again. Whereas daily torpor is highly synchronized with the daylight cycle, and it is less than 24 hours.
Now, I have to admit, before I read your book, I was a person who believed the Holarctic hibernation paradigm. I believe that this included animals right around here in Massachusetts, that animals went into hibernation because the external temperature was cold and they couldn't find the food that they needed, and therefore, because it was so cold, that's when they hibernated. But your research has shown that air temperature may not influence when some animals hibernate.
What do you mean by that, Mark?
Well, that it's not, you know, that you've discovered that hibernation exists in the tropics. That would be the last place that people up here would think that animals would be hibernating.
Well, you see, the thing is, anyway, you know, the only way to understand what's happening at present in animals is to understand where they came from.
So that's right.
If you look back in the evolutionary history of the mammals, and we start looking at the characteristics that will indicate some form of endothermy, and there's an increasing number of studies which are really exciting studies which are using these methods of phylogenetic reconstruction. Let me give you an example. You can take a fossil bone of an animal that is 250 million years old. You can slice it, and you can measure the diameter of the microvasculature. In other words, the smallest little vessels that the blood has to move through. And from that, you can estimate the size of the red blood cells are. Now, it's very simple. Small blood cells are indicators of high metabolic rates, and large blood cells are indicators of low metabolic rates. And so from these, we can get ideas of what the metabolic rates were of these early mammals and trace the development through time in the last 250 million years. And you can clearly see this increase in endothermy. But the important point is this, that it's very expensive to maintain this constant body temperature through this form of heat production. And these animals were living in a highly unpredictable environments, particularly in the Triassic. And when they weren't breeding, they simply resorted back to the ancestral condition, which, of course, is endothermy. In other words, not producing any heat. And that toggling between the two forms was carried on all the way through the Triassic, the Jurassic, the Cretaceous, right until the present. And it's particularly common, of course, in small animals, and they do it when they're not breeding, especially in unpredictable environments. And that, I guess, is the difference between the Northern Hemisphere outlook and the Southern Hemisphere outlook. The Northern Hemisphere does not have these highly unpredictable systems. It's a very highly seasonal, predictable system. And the difference is exactly that. You know, if you understand that endothermy evolved in the highly unpredictable climate of the Triassic, then it's easy to imagine this toggling at these high temperatures. I mean, the Triassic was at least 15 degrees on average warmer than it is now. So it's really this capacity to put things in a timeline and understand this timeline that allows you to say, hey, these guys actually evolved in the tropics, not in the cold, snowy regions of the Northern Hemisphere.
So just to be clear, what you've discovered is that for some species of small mammals in the Southern Hemisphere, endothermy is not a permanent condition. In other words, absolutely not.
I mean,
The
good examples, of course, are tenrefs. They're just remarkable.
I want to stop there. You've done research on some of the most interesting mammals in the world. They're mammals that I've read about since I was a kid, the elephant shrew, the golden mole.
Yeah.
And then there's a section of this book that needs to be read by every field researcher. You did research in Madagascar on the lesser and greater hedgehog tenrex, which look a little bit like a hedgehog, a lot like a hedgehog. Now, before we talk about what you found, you ran into problems doing field research in Madagascar. I cannot imagine any other researcher coming across. What did you walk into when you started researching in Madagascar?
Well, we walked into a mountain of corruption for a start, and then a pretty violent guitar, which was really horrible. And then to put it in very simple terms, I guess, and these are my terms, and this is what I think. And then seeing the country being captured by Chinese syndicates, who then just demanded all the hardwood in the place, and it was absolutely terrible. We had to work in these forests at night, and knowing these syndicates were operating. So in the end, they gave us armed guards with AK-47s to protect my students in the forests. And it's really terrible. And it's just getting worse and worse. I'm not sure that it's any different today than it was when I did that research a couple of years ago.
And not only did all that happen, but then you found out that the native boas ate a lot of the tenrics.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Well,
Gordon.
That's an extraordinary place. When it comes to snakes, I mean, if you like snakes, go to Madagascar. You can go for a walk in the forest in the space of 1 hour. You might see 10 snakes. I mean, most people will see one snake every 10 years if they're lucky. I mean, yeah, I saw one last week, but the number of snakes in Madagascar is just crazy. But none of them are venomous. And so the locals don't care, and they just step over them. But, you know, having grown up in a country like South Africa where very few of them are non-venomous, you jump when you see a snake. And so they were laughing at us jumping the whole time seeing these snakes. But they ate our tenrics. They swallowed them, cold.
And the sad thing is that you had all sorts of electronic devices measuring body temperature on these tenrics, and you could track them by radio, and you would end up finding the snake with the tenric inside.
Yeah, that's right. And you end up following a snake, and if you actually missed the following of the snake, what you eventually found is just the puked up remains of the quills. And the radio transmitter together with the body temperature telemeters, and it's crazy. I mean, in my book, you can see actually quite a nice little set of data showing the temperature of the tenrec limited eaten by the snake, and then you see the temperature of the snake.
And I don't mean to laugh, but your poor students that were there doing doing a lot of the field work, they just, you know, yeah, it was just one thing after another. Now, let's get to what you found. What did you find out about tenrics in hibernation?
Well, there's two major issues, two major things that we found. The first, of course, is extraordinary long-term hibernation in the common tenrec. Huh. So these guys, once we had implanted them with a radio transmitter and the body temperature telemeters, they just dived into the sand in the forest, and my students would track them to the same spot in the sandy forest floor every day, and this went on for 9 months. They were pleading with me to dig it up because they were convinced that it was a snake with it. Swallowed the tenrec, puked up the telemeter underground, and that they were just wasting their time. But after 9 months, they heard that the batteries were going. You can hear it on the radio signal, on the transmitter signal. And they phoned me in South Africa and said, "What do we do?" I said, "Dig them up. We need those data." And they dug them up. There were three tenrecs alive and in deep hibernation. And then in half an hour, they were up to normal, well, there's no such thing as a normal body temperature in the tenrec, but they were certainly able to bite you.
So,
that is the most extraordinary thing, because typically in hibernators must arouse after several weeks in the most extreme cases, just in order to restore the biochemical balances that occur. Ischemia, in other words, the deprivation of oxygen to the cells. And then after 24 hours, once that's restored, they go back down again. But this is the first mammal that has not shown that. And it's really curious as to why that should happen. And the only thing that I can think of is that if you look at the temperatures at which they hibernated, then the body temperature was never below 22 degrees Celsius, which I'm not sure what that is in Fahrenheit or Fahrenheit. But it's a fairly warmish temperature. It's not a cold temperature. And so I don't think that these animals were actually incurring any ischemic damage at that temperature. And that allowed them to just remain in this hypometabolic for such a long period of time. And, you know, that's why I say that NASA should be interested in this, because, maybe it'll help them put astronauts in some form of hibernation state on their way to Mars.
So are tenrecs essentially ectotherms when they're not breeding, and then they become endothermic when they breed?
That's exactly the case in the spiny tenrecs. And the smaller spiny tenrecs, they seem to be completely switched off when they're not breeding, and they just allow their body temperatures to follow the air temperature. And then when they arouse, they get going in early summer, they mate, they breed, and then they switch off again. It's they really are, you know, toggling between endothermy and ectothermy all the time.
We're amazingly.
And it makes that. That's why, you know. That's exactly why I can trace this back to an early condition. Because if you look at the mammal tree, if you look at the placental mammals and their evolution, the tenrecs are one of the very first groups to have evolved. So they must carry these ancient conditions, for example, from the Cretaceous.
Right. We are.
In other words, before the dinosaurs went extinct. Yeah.
Amazingly enough, we're out of time, and I have about 3 more pages of questions to ask, but we're completely out of time. My guest tonight, I didn't even get to talk about metabolism, which was an amazing part of this book, pronghorns and all sorts of stuff. There's a lot in this book. My guest tonight has been Barry Gordon Lovegrove. He's a professor emeritus in the School of Life Sciences, University of KwaZulu-Natal. And we've been talking about his book. I really recommend this book. It'll, especially if you're from the Northern Hemisphere, it'll change your mind. Fires of Life, Endothermy in Birds and Mammals. Barry, it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for inviting me on your show.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.